last case, EFN West Palm Motor Sales versus Hyundai Motor America. Okay, Mr. Bartolomucci.
May it please the court, Chris Bartolomucci for the dealer appellants. I've reserved 2 minutes for rebuttal. In this case, the district court did not find any actual reputational harm. The court's summary judgment opinion actually said that the court was taking no position on that question. And this is a problem for Hyundai because the Florida Dealer Protection Act says a termination is unlawful without good cause, and moreover, a manufacturer like Hyundai carries the burden of proof on that issue.
Wasn't there a word you just skipped in reading that? Can you read the statute? I assume you have the statute in front of you.
I agree with the statute.
Can you just read that part word for word, the good cause or the good faith part?
It says, a discontinuation, cancellation, or a non-renewal of a franchise agreement is unfair if it is not clearly permitted by the franchise agreement.
Right.
Is not undertaken in good faith.
That's the word that I think we skipped over, the undertaken part. So isn't the reference point the undertaking, not the consequence? In other words, you want us to focus on whether there was actual harm or not. That's what you just started off by arguing. But it seems to me that the statute looks at the undertaking of it when we don't know what the consequence is going to be. It may turn out that, as you point out, that no one decided to buy less Hyundais as a result of an affiliate of the dealer raping somebody, but that just happened to be the case. One, the question seems to be whether, in good faith, someone could believe that, or a dealer, or the manufacturer could believe that, right?
Well, Your Honor, the undertaking in this case, the termination, occurred some 2 years after the arrest. So I think that is the relevant point in time.
That might be, but it's not what happens after that point, which seems to be what a lot of your brief is tailored towards. It's at the time the decision was made, right? You agree with that?
No, I believe that the good cause is assessed at the time the termination occurs. And that's, so there's like a 2 year.
Well, it says undertaken. It doesn't say when it occurs. Because as you know, there has to be notice and good faith. There has to be notice and opportunity to respond. And in fact, not only was there notice and opportunity to respond, but the manufacturer provided you with a second notice and a second opportunity to respond.
Well, the termination certainly isn't undertaken at the point at which Eddie Napleton was arrested.
Agreed. So let's call it when the notice is sent out. I think that's a fair under.
Sure.
Okay.
And even if that's the relevant time period, Hyundai presented no evidence of any actual reputational harm. The district court didn't find any. And although it had the burden of proof,
is the objective belief or the subjective belief that it could happen or it could be a problem, especially as a trial is coming up and especially as a plea is set and especially as now as there's a whistleblower who's now public who has now said that your client told him the lie in order to cover up the problem, is that not a possibility that someone could think that this could blow up even further or this could be a problem for the dealer?
Well, Your Honor, the test is whether there was good cause.
Right.
Good cause at the time of termination.
A reasonable belief.
No, not a reasonable belief. Good cause is the statutory term.
Right.
And that's more than just a subjective opinion.
Right.
The agreement is all about subjective opinion. It's any conduct which, in Hyundai's opinion, impairs the reputation.
There's sole discretion.
Yes, and my answer to your question, Chief Judge Pryor, is that the Florida Dealer Protection Act trumps the contract and actually writes terms into the contract. So the contract may say opinion, but the act, which takes precedence, says you have to have good faith, good cause, it must be a material.
I don't understand the conflict. I don't understand the conflict between having that opinion, which can be a good faith opinion, that it impairs the reputation. I mean, you can point out, oh, sales didn't suffer. Sales might have even been greater. They could think that.
They were wrong.
Could have even been much greater.
You don't know. Sales were greater than they'd been before. This is a common fallacy. We see it all the time. But you don't know that they were greater than they would have been.
That's right.
And no expert, no matter how much you pay him an hour, can tell what they would have been but for this.
But here's the full argument, Your Honor. They have the burden of proof. We put on experts who said, according to the auto metrics, sales, customers, et cetera, you were doing better than before. And they didn't put on any expert testimony.
You were doing greater than before, but not you were doing greater than you would have done had he not besmirched the reputation of this dealership.
Well, Hyundai didn't make that case, even though it had the burden of proof. Its position has always been...
It doesn't have to prove that.
It has to demonstrate good cause. And in this context, good cause means that you had good cause to believe there was reputational harm.
No, where does it say that? Good cause, as I understand it, and the best that we have, as I understand it, is the Copens Motors, is the DO, the DOA opinions, which say that the good cause is neither the best nor any cause, but cause that is, quote, good, reasonable, and substantial, right?
Well, yes, Your Honor, but they terminated for... reputational harm.
Right, but isn't
good cause to believe?
Right, he did. They had pretty good evidence that he did it, and is it not logical that by doing this, and was it not testified to by a number of people in the industry that this could harm us? In other words, there was an actual a belief that he committed this crime, or that there was some basis to believe he committed it. There was a video. B, they had a belief that, because he shared the same last name and was affiliated with the company, that, and this was in the news, that this could harm.
Well, Your Honor, this got litigated on summary judgment. The district court said, I'm not finding actual reputation.
None of what I just said had anything to do with actual. What I just said is, there are two things that they say, and that seem to me to be good, reasonable, and substantial. One, that he committed a heinous crime. They believed it. And there was evidence to support it, and B, that the heinous crime could have besmirched either the brand or the dealership.
Well, I reject the notion that it's a could-have standard. They have to show good cause, and they bear the burden.
Cause, not that it happened, and it was, again, at the undertaking.
They have to have good cause for their opinion that there was reputational harm, and here, that evidence is absent.
Isn't the logical belief that this heinous crime done with the namesake of the dealership, with an affiliate of the dealership, that was widely reported in the neighborhood, in the area, have affected it? Isn't that enough?
It's not enough, because that evidence didn't come in on summary judgment.
Everything I just said came in. Everything I just said came in.
Well, what didn't come in is any expert evidence to support this intuition that there was...
But it's good cause. It's not that it happened. I mean, there's no, it actually happened. Then when you add the good cause to the underlay, as my colleagues have said, the contract, the good cause simply has to be that you believe that you, in your sole discretion, believe this to be reputational harm.
Well, no, we would submit that good cause means that they had to demonstrate actual reputational harm. And that's
where are you getting that from?
I think that's what good cause means, but also there's a separate statutory provision that says it has to be a material and substantial breach. And our position is that if there's...
You're saying, I just want to be clear, you're saying that if anything, forget what it was, but whatever it is, they have to consult an expert who then has to confirm that, in fact, the consequence of it would be? How is that consistent with the language that says at the undertaking? Let me ask you a hypothetical. Imagine at the day after the arrest, so no way to be able to measure this, before it even hit the news, the day after the arrest, they sent the letter. Would that not be undertaken with good cause?
Well, I don't know that they would have any evidence of reputational harm.
But that's not my question.
Wait for the expert, you see.
Right, that's not my question. My question is, would that not be good cause?
I don't think it is good cause if you're making a snap decision without any...
How is it a snap decision if you're...
It's your opinion.
They're in the money-making...
That's what matters under the contract.
The contract also says it has to be the conduct of the dealer.
It says any conduct, and unlike other provisions of the contract that are actually referenced as to specific persons to whom that contract has to be attributable, this is not.
Well, it says any conduct, but that term is surrounded by 20 other subsections that either expressly say the dealer or...
Isn't that indicative that, I think what Chief Judge Pryor is asking, and I have the same thought, which is, isn't that indicative that it's purposely done to take out the dealer? In other words, there's a list of 20 provisions and 19 of them say and dealer or as to the dealer, but provision 20 explicitly doesn't. Isn't that indicative of that it isn't meant to apply to the dealer?
It's the opposite, Your Honor. In fact, I would refer you to this court's decision in Calderon, where there were only 5 subsections. And the court said, look, all of these provisions seem to be talking about Orbitz's activity, so we're going to construe the phrase, any services or product provided, to mean by Orbitz. And here we've got 20 surrounding provisions that are all talking about the dealer. Those inform the way you construe the reputation clause, and the best reading of that clause, really the only reading that we think is appropriate, is that it means the conduct of the dealer.
Even where there's a parallel clause dealing with felonies, so a smaller subset, where it specifically references the manager, it gives a lit owner or manager, as opposed to here where it's a broader category and seems to not include those things?
I think the existence of that other section helps us.
Well, I know you point to the specific general canon, but the problem is that canon only applies where both apply to the situation. In other words, where there's a specific and general, you apply. But here, the specific doesn't apply to this situation, so there isn't something in which to say that you have to apply the specific over the general.
They both apply to the alleged reputational impairing effect of criminal conduct. And Hyundai doesn't dispute that the provisions over...
Let me ask it this way. Is there any case in the history of all cases in Florida or federal statutory interpretation that apply the specific general where the specific doesn't apply to this case in this situation?
I don't have a case to cite to you, Your Honor, but I...
I think the answer is probably no.
I would also point out that the enumeration of the types of individuals in the other provision should have some bearing on how you interpret the reputation clause. It lists the dealer, the
bearing.
Officer.
It has bearing. It doesn't help you.
Well, Your Honor, well,
I mean, when you've got an affiliate like this, I mean, here is someone who may not fall into those other categories where there are those specific references, but this is certainly someone who is, as Judge Luck has been saying, affiliated with the dealer, someone whose conduct could clearly affect the reputation of Hyundai.
Well, in my limited time, I want to raise the couple other issues we have in our brief. On the uniform and consistent issue, we pointed out on summary judgment that Hyundai didn't terminate Billy Walters or John Stilupi. Walters was convicted of felony wire fraud.
It seems to me, though, that there's material differences between them. So if we use, it seems to me you both are talking the comparator analysis, and so I sort of thought about it that way. And what we've said with comparators is they have to be substantially similar on material grounds. And so what are the material grounds? The nature of the crime, what the response was when noticed of it, was there a conviction, or was there, where was it at the time? Was it active or non-active? And it seems to me that all of them have significant material differences, right?
Well, this goes to the jury, Your Honor. I don't think that it was proper to the district.
Not in a Title VII case, it doesn't.
Well, in this case, I think it was proper for the district court to say, as a matter of law, all of your comparisons are materially different.
So in Stilupi, for example, there was never any charge. He was never arrested for anything, and it had nothing to do with a sex crime, right?
That's right.
Walters also had nothing to do with the sex crime. It was a fraud. It didn't happen in the location where the crime happened. He was indicted in New York, but his dealerships were in Georgia and California, and he specifically agreed to divest his shares so that there was some consequence for it.
I think these are arguments for the jury to hear. It wasn't for the district court which the district court didn't even...
But how can there be uniformity where there isn't uniformity in the comparator?
Well, they were convicted. Walters was convicted of a felony crime that was well publicized. I think that's sufficient to make it a relevant comparator, Your Honor.
Okay,
counsel, before you sit down, I have a question, if that's okay. Isn't the rapist, Eddie Napleton, in this case, part owner of the dealership through the LLC?
Your Honor, the joint stipulation of undisputed fact describes Ed, the father, as the person who...
I'm sorry, I thought in response to our jurisdictional question, it came back that he was a part owner through the LLC. Am I wrong about that?
If he has an ownership interest, Your Honor, it is infinitesimal.
I'm sorry. Does he own part of the dealership through the LLC, yes or no? You can't not know that.
Well, the record doesn't support any conclusion, Your Honor.
Does he own part of the dealership through the LLC, to your knowledge, as an officer of this court appearing before us now?
He has an extremely slight ownership interest in voting shares. He belongs to a trust. He has 9% of a company that has 1% of a company that owns the vote.
So he is a fractional owner.
The fraction is so infinitesimal, Your Honor, that there's no finding by the district court.
Okay. You're telling me it's a barleycorn? That's enough at the law.
Your Honor, I don't know what a barleycorn is, but what I'm telling you is that there was no finding about ownership here.
Let me tell you something else, and this is... I've about given up after 32 years of this, but to hear a lawyer say the district court found this or the district court found that or the district court didn't find this or that on an appeal from grant or denial of summary judgment, it doesn't matter. Our review is de novo. I understand the great temptation to bank on inertia carrying you through. Tie goes to the runner and that sort of thing. But that, I see our lawyers arguing, and I think you were arguing, it kind of, that's what the district court found, that's the end of the discussion. It isn't. It's just the beginning of the discussion because we have de novo review.
Then to be very clear, Your Honor, as an officer of the court, Eddie Napleton has a very small ownership interest.
Different subject. I've changed the page and gone to the next part, which is, it doesn't do me any good to hear an argument that we can't decide or shouldn't decide something different because the district court didn't. We give attention to and appreciate the views of the district court on summary judgment. Bench trial, they're near sacrosanct. But on summary judgment, it's just a springboard.
Well, since this is a court of review and not first review, I thought Your Honors would want to know that
we are first review on review from a grant of summary judgment.
But is de novo review? We certainly agree on that. Thank you,
Mr. Bartolomeucci. You saved 2 minutes. Is it Whitem?
Whitem,
yeah.
May it please the court. Good morning, Your Honors. Mitchell Whitem and Raquel Fernandez from Bills and Sundberg on behalf of Hyundai Motor Corporation. This case came before the district court on egregious facts. It was undisputed that Eddie Napleton, the son of the dealer principal in this case, the gentleman that signed these contracts, had sexually assaulted a woman that worked for and worked at the dealerships. It was undisputed that he was arrested. It was undisputed that he was indicted. It was undisputed that that was highly publicized in the local West Palm Beach newspapers.
Counsel, let me fast forward a little bit. I think we are all very familiar with the facts here. I want to talk about good faith. How is good faith judged in the context of the dealer statute?
Good faith is judged in exactly as Your Honor said. It is judged.
We were talking about good cause before. I think that's a shade different than good faith.
This court addressed that issue in Ernie Hare.
Did we address the issue? So in Ernie Hare, what we addressed, as I understand it, was that there we were talking about the contractual language and not the dealer statute. And what we said about good faith had to deal with the implied contractual duty of good faith under Florida law. Is that right?
That's correct.
Okay. Is this different, I guess, is my first question.
I don't believe it is.
Why is it not? In other words, the dealer statute seems to be, I'm not saying there's not overlap between them, but the dealer statute seems to be tailored at something different. First of all, it talks about the undertaking as opposed to the actual discretionary duty under a contract. And B, is there a subjective and component to it, especially because the contract language we're talking about is inherently subjective?
Yes, I believe there is, Your Honor. And I think this court addressed that in the Ernie Hare case. This court said when we have language that gives the manufacturer sole discretion, that means it's not for this court, it's not for the jury, it's not for a reasonable person to judge what the manufacturer did, but we look at what they did do and what they undertook.
Well, it could be for a jury if there's a dispute of fact, right?
If there's a dispute.
Okay, so they present some evidence, and I want you to deal with that evidence. What they say is, listen, if the manufacturer really believed this, they waited 2 years. The allegations came out, as you point out. It was widely publicized at the time. It is outrageous what happened here. And yet, nothing happened for 2 years. And in the meantime, all this fraud stuff came on, and this all happened contemporaneously with allegations of fraud. So this is kind of maybe a subterfuge for really a fraud termination. Plus, there was some hot tensions between the Napleton folks and the manufacturer underlying a lot of this stuff. And so that seems to indicate that maybe subjectively this really wasn't done in good faith, but was done as a way to terminate a relationship they weren't all that happy with, and for a reason that had nothing to do with the rape, but instead had to do with fraud allegations. Well,
let me go through, Judge, what the undisputed facts were about those issues. It was undisputed that starting in July, we started to look at
July of what year?
2020.
Okay, so that's a year and a half after the allegations, right?
That's correct. July of 2020, we met. We met again in August of 2020.
Right.
We met again in September of 2020, and then November. It was undisputed that we had extensive meetings to discuss exactly how to handle this properly. So there was no question that under the facts that were presented to the district court.
I know, that doesn't respond to literally anything I said before that. So let me put the three facts that I laid before you. One is there's a year and a half gap from when this happens. If this is so outrageous, and it was publicized then, it's not like this came out later. The video was I think on the news the next day or within a week or two. There was the press conference with the victim. All that happened right away. And yet a year and a half ticks by and nothing happens until the whistleblower comes out. That prompts the meeting in July, and the whistleblower talks about the fraud stuff, the warranty fraud, and that's what starts this. The warranty stuff is going on contemporaneous with these discussions, and there was some underlying what I'll call tension between the Napleton folks generally and Hyundai, the manufacturer. Is any of what I've said also undisputed?
All of that is undisputed.
So if that's the case, why can't a reasonable jury looking at those say, yes, I understand what Hyundai says, and Hyundai could have acted in good faith under these facts, but a reasonable jury could conclude that maybe this wasn't done in good faith, that it was actually done because A, they wanted out of their relationship with Napleton, and B, that they were really trying to punish the fraud, and they were just trying to use this as a belt and suspenders approach in order to do that.
Well, the testimony, Judge, was first let me deal with the evidence,
yeah,
and then let me deal with the contractual language, because they both apply to answer your
sure
question. First, as to the testimony, the evidence was that we didn't want to have a rush to judgment here. We were trying to do the right thing. We weren't trying to just jump in and make a conclusion of what to do here.
How do you contrast that with the fraud allegations, though? Because as I understand it, that the allegations came out of fraud in the summer of 2020. I don't know the exact date off the top of my head, but in the summer of 2020. And then the letter went out, what, in November or October?
November.
Right. So that there's a much more of a rush to judgment for that than there was for this, right?
Well, and there were some specific emails and things about that, but there we had definitive proof that they were essentially defrauding us, which ultimately a jury found that the general manager and the two lead people that were at the dealership committed fraud against us, that they were submitting fraudulent warranty submissions to us. So that actually, we knew that was occurring. But here, Your Honor, let's go back, because the critical thing here is also the language of this contract. And in the Ernie O'Hare case, the exact same allegations that they're making to this court, that there was a plethora of motives, improper motives that occurred, that there was, that Ernie Hare, in that case, they didn't follow 9 of 10 procedures that they had, that they had previously told them, oh, you should do this relocation. When you have sole discretion, like we had in this contract, because our brand and reputation is so important to us, it's the most critical thing that a car dealer has and manufacturer, we have the right here to, in these kinds of facts, to make the decision that we no longer should want to be or should be in business,
counsel,
with someone who acts like this.
When you say you had sole discretion, you're ignoring the statute. You know better than we, although some of us know, that there's competitive tension and differing interest between the dealers and the manufacturer. It's in every single state. And the dealers have the upper hand in the state legislature.
Absolutely.
And they get restrictions put on the manufacturers. Pick a state. It's happened.
Yeah.
And this is a restriction that was intended to limit the manufacturer's sole discretion. For example, a breach has to be material and substantial. And you can't say, don't worry about that, it's in our sole discretion. It's not.
And I agree with Your Honor, this of course was not a breach. And they go through,
although you said it was.
No, this was not a, what we were dealing with here was not a breach.
I thought you sent the intent to terminate letter that said they breached the contract.
In the notice.
Yes, in the notice we did say that. And that was incorrect in the notice. And we have cited to the court the case of Irvin, this court's decision in Irvin. The fact that the notice had some improper wording does not invalidate it.
Did you correct that error?
We did not officially correct that error. I will tell the court.
Unofficially, did you pick up the phone and call those sides and said, my bad? We take it back.
We didn't mean it. We
didn't,
but I would tell the court that we sent out a 3-page notice that laid out all of the facts upon which we were terminating, including the provisions of the contract. As this court said in Irvin, this court said all that is required in a notice is that you provide the other side with the facts and the ability to rebut those facts. When they rebutted those facts, they came back and said, this is not a breach. You're alleging something that is not a breach. So we know there was no prejudice to them, because you'll see in the record when they responded to us, in their 3-page response to our 3-page notice, they said, there's no obligations about reputation in the contract. This is not a breach. We know it's not a breach. So they weren't prejudiced by that. They were able to rebut that. And if you look at the cases that they cite,
counsel, Judge Carnes' larger point is, it isn't just about your sole discretion under the contract. And what separates Ernie Hare, which was a contract-only case, from this case, which is what Judge Carnes has said and what Chief Judge Pryor said, which is a dealer statute which has independent protections that set a floor despite the contract. When you're dealing with that, I then go back to the questions that I asked about the evidence. Could not a reasonable jury look at that and say, you know what, I could see how maybe someone didn't undertake this a year and a half after it happened in good faith with all this other stuff going on?
I don't think so, Your Honor, because as you look at those other facts, they didn't raise an issue of fact as to our good faith or our good cause here. Faced with these egregious facts that we were faced with, there is no, as this court said in Ernie Hare, relying on the CEPI decision, which talked directly about good faith, and there's no difference essentially between good faith that's discussed in the CEPI case and good faith that's in the statute. There is no reasonable person faced with these facts that would come to a different conclusion. That case said, CEPI said, if any one person, any one single person,
what fact is, counsel, what fact is different from what the incident happened? Is it December of 2019, November of 2019?
Yes.
So from end of 2019 when the incident happened to summer of 2020 or November of 2020 when the letter goes, the notice goes out.
There were other things that were happening. There was the Jane Doe lawsuit came out. There was the Mark Edelman suit came out. As Your Honor pointed out, Mr. Edelman's suit came out and said that Mr. Napleton had admitted the rape to him and had asked him to lie to
them. Is there undisputed evidence in the record that suggests that those two things, the Jane Doe lawsuit and the Edelman allegations coming out, that those two things are what tipped the scale to then, all right, this is enough, we have to pull the trigger?
Absolutely, Your Honor. If you look at our notice, the three-page notice that we sent them included all of those facts as part of our decision, including what no one has talked about is, and very critical, as Your Honor pointed out, which differentiates the Walters case and the other cases, is that when we reached out to them and said, look, this is what has been alleged to us has occurred. Mm-hmm. Please explain to us what you're going to do. How are you going to handle this? And they wrote back, no law or policy has been violated here. Nothing has been done wrong.
Unproven allegations.
That's right. And we then gave them 30 extra days to come back to us.
What would have been enough if they said that Mr. Napleton Jr. is no longer associated with any of the Napleton companies? Would that have done it?
That certainly would have gone a long way to, and in fact, the proof is kind of in the pudding because.
But in a world where we've seen the Duke lacrosse team and many other horrible allegations later fall apart, doing a little due diligence and waiting and trying to investigate is prudent.
Yes, and in William Walters' case, that's exactly what he came back and said to us. He said, you know what, and as the court pointed out, his name wasn't associated with the dealerships like Napleton, but in that case, he said, I'm going to divest myself of these dealerships. He immediately put the dealerships in the name of a third person and his wife, and he said, I will sell the dealerships, and he did.
Why should we use the comparator Title VII-ish framework for the uniform standard in the contract? That does seem a little odd to me to use a comparator framework. Why is it not enough just to say, these guys committed crimes or alleged to committed crimes, your guy was alleged to have committed a crime, you treated these differently than this guy, the jury can decide?
Because as Your Honor pointed out, the case law and all the DOA decisions recognize exactly what that standard should be. The dealers are not all treated similarly situated. You look at exactly what Your Honor said. You look at what is the crime that's been committed. Is the dealer's name connected to is the dealer principal's name connected to the dealership? How did they react to your letter? Here we gave them notice. In the cases, for example, in the Sonic case, which they raise, when we sent the letter to Mr. Smith, whose name was not connected to the dealership, he wrote back immediately and said, within 22 days, all charges have been dropped against me. We withdrew we had done the same letter we sent to them, we had sent to Sonic. We withdrew the letter. Here, the exact opposite happened. Here, not only did they say no law or policy has been violated, in 30 days when we wrote them again, they doubled down on it, and they issued a press release, which the dealer principal himself said, this applies to all our dealerships, and all, including these two dealerships, were instructed to say no law or policy has been violated. Okay. We respectfully ask this court to affirm the decision of the district court. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Whittem. Mr. Bartolomucci, you have 2 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'd like to pick up on the good faith issue that Judge Luck raised. Whether a party has acted in good faith or bad faith is a classic issue for the jury. So we would submit that the district court erred by deciding this on summary judgment, especially since under the Dealer Act, Hyundai bears the burden of proof to establish its good faith. And the timeline, Judge Luck, is even worse for them than I think you sketched it out to be. The arrest occurs in February of 2019. For almost 2 years, for 21 months, Hyundai takes no action, no letter, no investigation, nothing until November of 2020.
That's, as I understand it, though, the undisputed evidence, and I think I'm looking at the corporate representative deposition, the 30B6 deposition of Mr. Parker, was his name, who says that we were studying this at that time. In other words, the undisputed evidence doesn't seem to be that they were twiddling their thumbs or ignoring this. I think what they said was they were actually studying this. I can point to the page if you want.
Well, Your Honor,
I
believe in our brief, we quoted his testimony that said, our investigation began when we sent the notice of deficiency. And that was in November of 2020. Of course, it's also the same day that
that can't be. I mean, as a matter of logic, that can't be true. In other words,
you can't.
I know, but you can't send the notice with all the stuff in there and say that you have never investigated until the notice went out. I mean,
it's certainly true that they didn't send anything to the dealerships until November of 2020, which was on the exact same day that they decided to terminate.
I thought the 30B6 representative said that the legal counsel was doing the investigation and therefore there was a privilege issue in the deposition.
Well, they bear the burden of proof, Your Honor. If they don't want to put on evidence, then
that doesn't mean, though, that there wasn't an investigation. Well, if he's saying that counsel was doing it.
I'm looking at docket entry 246-9, which is the Parker deposition. At pages 66 through 68, he testifies that they were aware of it, that it was on the local news in February of 2019. They took the allegations very seriously. The company became very concerned, was the testimony, once the press release came out, the one that was referred to, and that Mr. Parker testified, was described it as, quote, very, very disappointing because it failed to follow any due process by blindly standing by Mr. Napleton Jr. without further investigation. He acknowledged that the company knew of the situation as heinous at that particular point and was very damaging, and that they decided to gather information and seek direction from counsel, which is what the chief judge was referring to.
Well, Your Honor, my answer would be, this is why there's a fact question for the jury, because it took them 21 months to send a notice of deficiency, and they only did that after they have decided to terminate for alleged warranty fraud, which claims were rejected in a different case that's now on appeal to this court.
Okay. I think we understand your case, and we're going to be in recess for the rest of the day. Thank you.
All right.